Head over to Mark's Gospel. We are one day closer to winding this up. That's one of the kids just got filled with the Holy Spirit, right?
Wow!
I remember those days. Mark the 15th chapter. And we're going to finish that up and move right into the 16th chapter today. And we are, after today, we'll be one more study closer to completing Mark's Gospel. My plan is to get us through the 8th verse today of the 16th chapter. We're going to catch that little bit that's left in the 15th chapter. And then next week, we're going to get real direct and really take a good, hard look, not an overwhelming look, but I'm going to give you all the highlights of these notorious last 12 verses of the 16th chapter of Mark. Give you a little history, give you a little background. It's in our King James text. If you have a text like New American Standard or something like that, you're going to have like footnotes, you know, side notes or something like that. Making statements about, you know, dubious statements like the best and oldest manuscripts do not contain, you know, verses 9 through 20, you know. And then, of course, the little red flag goes up, and what do you say when you read that? You go, yeah, why? And it never gets really talked about, you know. I don't have an axe to grind about this, but I think this is something that we all need to focus on. Anyway, we're going to try to do that next week. We're going to see what's good about it, what's not so good about it, and look at it just very matter-of-factly. I'll talk to you about, you know, the transmission and manuscript evidence as to why this should not be considered part of Mark's original gospel. We'll look at all of that, and now, you know, see, I've already let the cat out of the bag now. You already know I'm going to say what I'm going to say, but I want you to know why. You don't have to agree with it, but I want you to know why this is. There's some real theological error in these verses. It's error, you know, and I will compare it to other scriptures, and, you know, you reach your own conclusion. And no, actually, in this church, the conclusion is what I tell you, right? No, you listen and you study, you make the comparison. It's funny because sometimes some of you on occasion will go, you know, I don't agree with you in regards to that. Okay, you know, if you want to talk about it some more, we can, and usually you do. And sometimes you end up changing your mind. And other times it's like, no, you know, okay. May the Lord bring us all into the same mind. And when I say that, I'm not saying that there's something serious, you know. We're not talking about, nobody comes up to me and says, yeah, I don't think Jesus came out of the tomb. No. But some issues that are maybe, you know, a little ways down on the ladder right there, that may just be my opinion on a certain matter. That's what I'm talking about. But in any case, we're in the end of the 15th chapter of Mark. Christ in our study right here has just dismissed his spirit as he is on the cross. He was on the cross for a very short time, approximately 6 hours. I've talked to you about the fact that the cross, of course, was a torture method to keep one alive for as long as possible while enduring horrible physical agony and pain. Every part of the body, of course, was affected by this. And really, when people died on the cross, you know, they couldn't breathe. You know, like they can't breathe. It's like being strangled because your lungs fill up with fluid over time, and you're constantly trying to push yourself up with your legs that are nailed to this bottom part of the beam, and you're trying to use that, and there was always a little bit of a step right there. That's what they nailed you to. And you try to push yourself up while you're hanging like this, but you can't for the most part. You've just got nothing, and so all this fluid begins to fill up inside of your lungs. You just suffocate, you see. That's how death usually took place, unless they came along like they did with the two thieves on both sides of the cross of Christ, and they broke their legs to send that shock through their system to hasten death. And of course, the Jews asked that would be done because the Sabbath and Passover, which fell on the Sabbath that year, was hastening on. Jesus was crucified on a Friday, which, as we've pointed out to you, is the preparation day, and we've been all the way through that. Now, today we are approaching the fact of Jesus' resurrection. And the focus here is on the witnesses to the resurrection. That he literally, tangibly, absolutely, completely, without question, came out of that tomb on the third day. And the focus is on the witnesses. Now, I brought this up to you last week. Our prima facie witnesses of this event are not the disciples, not the 12, not some king. It's these women. And it's these women who have a history of serving Christ, of believing on him early. I believe these women that we'll touch on here were regenerated long before the 12. You know, I question the regeneration of the 12, and I've shown you why in the Scripture. During the lifetime of Jesus, there's some real problems that are going on here. And I think that a lot of it got taken care of, at least by the day of Pentecost, 40 days after his resurrection. But in any case, Jesus has just dismissed his spirit. Verse 38 of chapter 15, the veil in the temple has rent. We saw the great theological implications in regards to all that. Verse 39, the centurion who is a master of death, if you will, knowing how to afflict it and has seen plenty of people die because he's caused it for, we could probably be safely saying, many years. These guys were experts, these Roman soldiers, at dealing out death. He then is a witness to Christ's death, and then at the bottom of 39 says, truly this man was the Son of God, or was, indefinite article, Son of God. In English we would say A, but that's not really accurate in the Greek. He's going to come up again, and he's going to show himself to be a witness to the actual death of Jesus. Now, why is that important? Because every now and then, throughout the last 2,000 years of history, this idea crops back up again that Jesus really didn't die on the cross. You know, the last guy to do this was Hugh Schoenfield back in the early 60s, and he wrote a book called The Passover Plot, in which he presented the so-called swoon theory. Well, it's not new. It sticks its head up now and then throughout the last 2,000 years of church history, where Jesus didn't really die, you see. No, well, hang on. I won't get into that right now. Let's just kind of keep rolling along. Verse 40, and said there were also women looking on afar off. Now, Mary was close. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was close. With John right there, close enough to hear Jesus on the cross, and he's not very high up, maybe a couple feet, really. Woman, behold your son, you know. And he gives John the responsibility of taking care of Mary. And then John's gospel says from that moment, he took her into his household. So we've got these other women that are watching afar off, maybe out of respect. You know what I'm saying? Mary's right there. John's right there. And that had to be pretty hairy and pretty scary, because this is, forget the photos. Forget the, I got a photo of the crucifixion. It'll go up on eBay soon. Yeah. Forget the portraits that we've seen painted. I mean, this was not a clean place, Golgotha. And I'm convinced this is Gordon's Calvary. We'll talk about this a little bit later. Because it's outside the city walls. It's right along the highway that leads up into the city. And it was known that this place where Jesus was crucified, as well as, I believe it's Matthew's gospel says, was nearby the highway, close to the city, but outside of the walls. See, the other place that they've got for supposedly the traditional place of Jesus' tomb is inside the city walls. But that goes against Hebrews 13, which says Jesus was crucified outside of the walls. And the so-called sepulcher, the Holy Sepulcher, which is inside Jerusalem, that you can go visit right now, that is all tricked out with all kinds of nonsense since about the 4th century, this comes from Constantine's mother. She was on a little Holy Land tour visiting around, and because she visited this site, then the son, Constantine, you know, the Roman Empire at the time, holified, you know, the place, and it's been known as, you know, the place of Jesus' resurrection. Well, it's absolutely not. We'll talk about this again in just a little while right here. I'm trying to give you this little bit of a picture. But Golgotha, a bloody mess. Talk about flies everywhere and just death and vile. You have to understand, when these guys are being tortured like this, there's vomit, there's other orifices opening and things coming out, the smell, the stench, okay? Yeah. A horrific place. You see, I mean, Mary gets right down close enough where Jesus can give John the responsibility for mom. This is a horrible, horrible situation. This is, what more can I say about that? So these other women, it says in verse 40, are standing afar off. And then we get them named. Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the Less, and Joseph, and Salome. Now, Mary the mother of James the Less, we can't be 100% sure. This could be Mother Mary at one point standing off with the women before she got closer. This could be somebody else. It's a little tough to tell. Nobody can be 100% absolute. However, we can be absolute about Mary Magdalene, out of whom he cast seven demons. We can be sure about Salome, bottom of verse 40. That's the wife of Zebedee, the mother of James and John, the two apostles. Her first name is Salome. We know that from Matthew 27, verse 56, which I shared with you last week. 41, who also, when he was in Galilee, followed him and ministered unto him, and many other women which came up with him unto Jerusalem. What that's telling us is that there were other women besides these three that got named right here that are witnesses. Now, this is going to be important because these ladies are going to go with Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus after they've taken the body of Christ down, and they're moving him quickly into Joseph of Arimathea, who was the great uncle of Jesus, by the way. Did you know that? We talked about that last week. All right. That tomb was located very close to Golgotha. You can go to that tomb this day, and you can get inside of that. It's fascinating. There's no trinkets. There's no garbage there, you know. Yes, garbage. You know, I despise the history of the big church, you know, that gets all the recognition. And the real church, my opinion, is underground. It's underneath, you know. And anyway, another subject for another time. But it was this church in the West and in the East, the Roman Catholic Church, the Eastern Orthodox in the East, that the function is on, and they take this stuff and they turn it into what they turn it into. And it's all fleshy and this kind of a thing, and it's most of the time it's never accurate as to historical representation. Luther used to say, you know, there's enough pieces of the cross that are supposed to be the genuine part of the genuine cross of Christ that a boat could be built, a ship could be built out of it. This thing is so huge, you know. And he used to mock, you know, in that way. I love Luther. He was my guy, you know, a little loose on the booze, you know, but he was my guy. He was like, yeah, he opened his mouth, and yeah, foot maybe insert every now and then. But, you know, these are the kind of people that God uses, I mean, to affect big things. Most of the stuff you read church history and the individuals involved, you know, on the righteous side of things, you know, are fat mouths and people who maybe didn't want to get into the fray, you know, but once they were in, guys like Jan Hus, known to us as John Hus, from Prague, he was preaching justification by faith before Luther. And the Catholics got a hold of him and killed him, you know, burned him at the stake as quick as they possibly could. Snuffed that whole thing out, you know. He wanted people to read the Bible in their vernacular. And the Catholics, you know, opposed to that. You know. Tony, you're supposed to be going and this, you know. You were thinking about it. Yeah, I was kind of waiting for... Oh, you were going to give me... So I got 2 minutes coming? I got 2 minutes coming! In any case, we'll talk about that tomb and Gordon's Calvary right here. So we've got these women. Other women following. I talked to you about Luke 8, verses 2 through 3. Talks about Joanna, the wife of Chuza. She was one who would follow Jesus. She could have been there as well. And then we've got the sister of Mother Mary. In other words, those whom we can lock down on are at least four women, maybe five or more, that witness this, that are going to go on their way to the tomb and are going to see where the tomb is, and some are even going to go inside and they're going to see how and where Jesus' body was laid. That's going to be important because, well, I'll wait. And so the evening comes, verse 42, it's the preparation day. They don't want, you know, the bodies to be on the cross. Here comes Joseph of Arimathea, which I've talked to you about last week, waiting for the kingdom of God. He's a part of the Sanhedrin, that's what it means by honorable counselor. Goes in boldly unto Pilate and craves the body of Jesus. Now let's pick up. And Pilate marveled if he were already dead. And calling unto him the centurion, he asked him whether he had been any while dead. And when he knew it of the centurion, he gave the body to Joseph. And he brought fine linen and took him down and wrapped him in the linen, laid him in a sepulcher which was hewn out of the rock, and rolled a stone under the door of the sepulcher. And Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joseph beheld where he was laid. And when the Sabbath was past, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome had brought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. Now remember, at the end of Luke 23, it says that the women then rested on the Sabbath, crucified on a Friday, Preppers Day, then they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment, that would be the fourth commandment, and then the next morning, early, they go ahead and they make their purchase, probably, because the stores, you know, are open really early, you know, the next day, but not before the Sabbath is over. Or they could have done it prior for that. Then they end up coming, okay? So Mark doesn't quite include all of that. Verse 2, and very early in the morning, on the Miantone Sabbatone, they came unto the sepulcher at the rising of the sun. And they said among themselves, who shall roll us the stone away from the door of the sepulcher? And when they looked, they saw that the stone was rolled away, for it was very great. And entering into the sepulcher, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted. And he saith unto him, be not affrighted. Ye seek Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him. But go your way, tell his disciples and Peter that he goeth before you into Galilee. There shall ye see him as he said unto you. And they went out quickly and fled from the sepulchre, for they trembled and were amazed. Neither said they anything to any man, for they were afraid. The Gospel of Mark sort of ends in the same abrupt way that it starts. It starts in this same kind of abrupt way. And throughout the whole, the nature of the Gospel of Mark is bang, 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 man, we're moving. Things are happening. Even though there's in between events throughout Mark's Gospels, you know, we can look by comparing to other Gospel accounts that there's other things that are happening in between the events that Mark talks about. Bang, bang, bang. But it's like moving, 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 you know. Snapshot, snapshot, this kind of a thing. And bang, this thing comes to an end just like that. Jesus has been raised. Mark is supposed to be one of the earliest Gospels. It's my opinion, as I've studied the transmission process, I think that Matthew came first. But it's too close to be absolute about it. Certainly Mark was at least second. Mike could have been, you know, coterminous with Matthew, you know, that kind of a thing. Definitely Luke was after that, and then John certainly after that. But even Luke talks about at the beginning of Luke, you will see that as many have taken into account to write about the things concerning Christ, the things which are most certainly believed among us, you know. I too have, having full knowledge of all of this, he'd done a lot of research, go ahead and start writing as well. But he makes mention of the fact that many have written and made a compilation, a gospel account, you see, but they don't all survive because only four of them, do you see that? Only four of them, for you listening, I just held up five fingers. Only four of them got preserved and are recognized as inspired, of course. All right, so we have all this kind of thing happening right here. But this gospel, bang, just ends as quick as it starts. All right, let's back it up. Joseph of Arimathea, chapter 15, verse 43, has just come into Pilate. It is asking for the body, craving the body. Now, here's some. Remember, I told you last week we were giving a little information on Joseph of Arimathea. By the way, Arimathea is another name for Ramah, the city of Ramah. That's where Samuel was from, the prophet Samuel. So it's referring to his birthplace is what that is doing right there. However, I told you last week, the Bible says, and I gave you all the passages, that he was known as a rich man.
He made his money in the tin trade. He was hooked up between Palestine, Spain, Rome, of course, and all the way out to Great Britain. The British traditions of Glastonbury name him prominently and show records in regards to his involvement with the tin trade and manufacturing of tin items. And he was exporting, importing, and do that kind of thing back and forth. Probably the way he made all of his money. And, of course, this tomb that Jesus is about to be entombed in, the Gospels say, was Joseph's tomb. He had it borne out there. Now, isn't that interesting? Because it's like a stone's throw away from Golgotha. This torture place. You know, we look at, where's Grandma and Grandpa going to be buried? Oh, they have this lovely place. It's out at Forest Lawn, and the birds sing, and the trees. And, you know, yeah, but why, Joseph, what? He's got this tomb, man. It's right next to, you know, where they flip the switch on the electric chair. And worse. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. There's no text that states, you know, that God appeared to him in a dream and say, you're going to make this tomb out for my son. It's going to be on the preparation day. They're going to need to bury him quick. So we're going to need to have a place for... No, nothing like that. But isn't it interesting how it's there? Don't know at what point, you know, he dug it out. But it says he hewed it out of stone. We'll talk a little bit more about that. He goes in and craves the body of Jesus. Now, criminals under Roman law, and Jesus would have come under this category as one who was crucified, forfeit all rights to burial. When you're put to death by Rome as a criminal, you forfeit all rights to burial. However, they will hand the body over to a relative, and to a relative only. Joseph of Arimathea, according to the genealogical records, was the great uncle of Jesus on Mary's side. 44, and Pilate marveled if he was already dead. 6 hours on the cross? How could he be dead? And calling him the centurion, he asked him whether he had been any while dead. And when he knew it of the centurion, he gave the body to Joseph, because Joseph was a relative. So the centurion comes, the one who, same guy, who at Golgotha, after Jesus cried, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit, to tetelestai. See, it's like, I don't mean to cheapen this, of course, but, you know, guys that are doing some great act or jumping out of the plane or, you know, flipping the switch and they're going to take out this group of the enemy soldiers and they're probably going to die with them. They cry Geronimo or something like that. It's kind of like that. It's that final victory cry. Tetelestai, the debt is paid. It's finished. And he dismissed his spirit. Work was done. No need to hang around. 6 hours. By the way, that's a miracle in and of itself. No man takes my life from me, Jesus said in John chapter 10. I have the power to lay it down and the power to take it again, because I was given this of my Father. And so he demonstrates that. 6 hours on the cross, that's all it took. Fine. 6 hours. Oh, interesting how that six in the Old Testament and the New Testament is the number of man. 6 hours. Six. In order to cover man, the elect out of mankind, out of Adam, 6 hours. You know? It's not in the Bible, this is not just like circumstantial stuff, or isn't that interesting? No, there's a plan. There's a purpose for this stuff. 6 hours. And so on the testimony of the centurion, he gives the body then to Joseph. Joseph then, of course, John's gospel makes this clear, gets a hold of Nicodemus, and no doubt there was some kind of an apparatus or a way to get up on the cross, but they both have to take him down. It takes the two of them. But looking at verse 46, and he brought fine linen, took him down, wrapped him in the linen, laid him in the sepulchre, which was hewn out of a rock. Now Matthew 27:60 says that was Joseph of Arimathea's own tomb, and rolled a stone under the door of the sepulchre. I'll talk to you about that stone in just a minute. This tomb, which is adjacent to Gordon's Calvary, you can tell it's a rich man's tomb. Most of the tombs for the average person that was dug out or hewn out of a rock, and that was some tough stuff. We're talking about who do you employ back then? They didn't have jackhammers or anything like that. They just chiseled away at this thing. Who had the money to get their own tomb made right out of the rock like that? You can tell this is a rich man's tomb. Many of the tombs that are like this tomb, you can actually, it has a sort of an entrance, a sort of an antechamber, an entrance that you can get in through. You have to stoop down a little bit. Many of them, you were down, bent over, working inside because, you know, the ceiling was right down on top of you. But many rich men's tombs, you can stand up in. It's kind of roomy sort of a thing. And there are cut-out places. If you were to go to this tomb at Gordon's Calvary, just outside of the walls of Jerusalem today, there will be three places for bodies to go. There's one primary place, which is sort of created. Well, it's not really a casket per se, but it sort of sticks up off the floor, you know, like a pedestal sort of a thing, in which is an indentation in the center where, you know, you could lay a body. And then over here on this side and over here on the other side, clearly was some sort of a family tomb of some sort, there were indentations in the rock where they had cut out a place for a body. Man, you know what I was thinking about the other day? If we ever get a chance to go over there, and you know I'm not a big fan of that, but if we were to ever get a chance to go over there, I'd want to lay down in that. Weird, huh? Just to do it, you know? Then I could come back and tell you this giant story about how I felt lightning coming up my spine. And then I could tell you which day the rapture was going to happen. I had lightning come up my spine. Sure it was your spine? Rapture? Okay. 47. And Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, beheld where he was laid. Now, just before we bust into the 16th chapter, this comment in verse 46, how he brought fine linen, took him down, wrapped him in it, laid him in the sepulcher. Obviously, that's like bang, 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 bang. You know, we got no details going on at all. You get the impression it's like almost like Mark was in a rush, you know, to get this thing done and get it off to the publishers or something. I mean, it's like, I got a deadline to meet, you know. Let's just slow down because there's some things I want you to see right here. In order to see what's happening here, let's go to the 19th chapter of John. John, the 19th chapter. Jesus has now paid for our sins. He has dismissed his spirit. The veil has rent. Joseph has gone to Pilate, and as a relative, he was able to secure permission to take the body. Probably had to have some kind of paperwork, or maybe just telling the centurion right there, because the centurion was in front of Pilate. Maybe that was good enough at that point. Let him have the body. So as the relative, as his great uncle, he gets custodial care over the body. We're not told when Nicodemus comes into the picture, but if you look at chapter 19, let's start at verse 38. Chapter 19 of John, verse 38. And after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave him permission. This is after he had talked to the centurion then. He came therefore and took the body of Jesus. And there came also Nicodemus. So Nicodemus was along with him. Now, as soon as they do this, this is a dead body. To compound, and that automatically made them ceremonial unclean according to the law. Even though the law was fulfilled at this point. The understanding of that was not happening. Isn't that interesting? And so, really, they were free from this. They really weren't contaminated. And of course, there's no information that says they went through the practice of becoming ceremonially pure in order for them to eat the Passover. However, according to Numbers, the 19th chapter, starting at verse 11, and pretty much through to the rest of the chapters, number 19 and verse 11, it goes through the various activities and processes, as if somebody dies next to you, and, you know, you're unclean. If you touch a dead body, unclean. If somebody dies in your house, they're on your bed or their bed, that bed is unclean. There's a whole list of ceremonial things, and they've got to go through the appropriate, you know, cleansing, and sometimes it takes days, you know, for this to happen. In fact, a minimum of 3 days, and usually
7, and in the middle of that 7-day cleansing system is the sprinkling of the water with hyssop and that kind of a thing. But in any case, here's something interesting, because in Joseph's mind, Joseph of Arimathea, and Nicodemus' mind, as soon as they touch this dead body, it's, in fact, even standing in Golgotha would do it, they're not going to be able to participate in the Passover, because that was that very next day. And the cleansing ritual, as you will see, if you want to take a look, not now, but later in Numbers 19, it took 7 days to go through this. So they knew they were forfeiting it. What is so important right here is that this is happening publicly. They are publicly making themselves unclean. This is not something happening in a little room somewhere, but they're testifying. This is their confession. They are confessing, if not the lordship of Christ, direct association with him, insofar that they are lifting him up and considering him to be somebody worthy to be made unclean over. Now, this is the way the Jews would have thought of it at that point. And so, together, I assume, according to this text, they're taking him down from the cross. This will be the third appearance of Nicodemus here in John's Gospel. The first appearance, as you know, John chapter 3, right? He comes to him at night. He's stealthy. He doesn't want to be seen. And Nicodemus comes to Jesus, and that is, of course, our whole born again by God's action teaching that is taking place right there. That seed of the word gets into Nicodemus. The next time we see Nicodemus is the end of John chapter 7, or close to the end right there. And Nicodemus is at the Sanhedrin. The topic is Jesus, and they're vilifying Jesus. And they're trying to come up with a way to have him destroyed. And Nicodemus steps up and says, "Does our law condemn a man before it does not hear him?" And then they turn on him. These vicious members of the Sanhedrin turn on him and says, "Are you, you know, a follower also, a disciple of his also? Search the scriptures. Nobody, no prophet comes out of Galilee." I guess they forgot about Isaiah, which speaks about God's word coming out of Galilee, you know. But that was the thing, you know. No prophet comes out of Galilee. Listen. Those people were not stupid. They knew he was from Nazareth. They had the birth documents. They kept it right there. The genealogical tables and records were right there in the temple. All got burned away in AD 70. No more records left because it isn't necessary. Not important anymore. Not necessary. Now, that's the Jews in the southern kingdom, who were not, you know, all of the tribe of Judah, and there were some of the other tribes, but that's southern kingdom stuff. Now, Ephraim, house of Joseph, the birthright house, is the northern kingdom. That's something else altogether. Something else entirely altogether. Now, by the way, commercial time. So, a week from next Sunday, or 2 weeks from today, we're into Hebrews. So get ready for that. Start reading ahead. We're into Hebrews. Ooh, baby. And then, what did I say? Well, about 2 weeks away, maybe, from starting our teaching in the Minor Prophets during the first service here. So I encourage you to come and start being a part of that. See, I'm going to be saying some things in our Minor Prophets teachings that unless you're listening online or you're getting a CD or something, because maybe you can't make it first thing, you're going to be missing out on some foundational things, which I'm going to bring up in Hebrews. And I want you to all be there, you know, with me in regards to that. So just trying to encourage you in regards to these things. Verse 39, "There came also Nicodemus, which at the first came to Jesus by night, brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight, and they took the body of Jesus," etc. Now, of course, you've heard me talk about this myrrh before. This was essentially a gummy resin. The aloes that's spoken of here, this is kind of an aromatic sandalwood. All you ladies know what that is, okay? Okay, so you take this gummy resin along with the linen strips, verse 40. They took the body of Jesus, wound it in linen. Strips would be better. So what we've got here, like I've told you before, is they've taken the body of Jesus. They would have quickly washed it as best they could. But they're moving fast because they got to make this happen before the sun goes down. Otherwise, they're in, you know, lawful legal trouble with the Jewish authorities because they would be seen as breaking Sabbath. So washing him down, and then they begin to wrap him. They put a sheet over him first, Then they wrapped him. And, of course, they would take this myrrh, this resin, and they would put it in between the strips. And of course, this stuff hardens, essentially. And that's going to be kind of important for what I'm about to show you in John's Gospel, which is the only Gospel that shows us this. All right. So, and then the sandalwood is just to delay, you know, the smell. And, of course, there's no embalming going on and nothing like that. You know, Jewish law was get it in the ground within 24 hours. So they're quick about this. Now, this is why the ladies are going to come back, you know, day after the next day. They're going to come back to try to finish this. They want to honor him. They realize that this is quick. Maybe even some of them, as Joseph and Nicodemus are getting the body into the tomb, maybe they, wait, I can go get, you know, right? Wouldn't they do that? I think they would. I just take me a second. I can just go, no, there's no time. See, we got to get this done. And it's like, it's driving these women crazy. I'm sure it's not making the men feel any better, you know. But Jesus had a special relationship, you know, with these holy women. I mean, I see that in these gospel accounts. It says at the bottom of verse 39 here that Nicodemus, man, he went to town here. Myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. You know, a Roman pound was 11.5 ounces. So it's probably, if you've got an ESV or a New American Standard, it might say 65 or 75 pounds, something like that. Okay, yeah, that's more like it right there. That's more like it. So about 100 pounds. The Greek doesn't really say pound. The Greek says litros ekaton. Ekaton, 100. Litros is a weight, or liter. Could be an open measurement of some kind of weight. In any case, if you see the difference, if you've got a King Jimmy and say, mine says 100, an ESV or New American Standards, or an NIV, or something like that. Oh, you don't have that anymore, right? You checked that, didn't you? Jen has been truly converted. She's like, oh, I used to have this NIV. I had to use my NIV, you know. It's got some good stuff in it, you know. But when I get down and get funky on the serious side, it doesn't help me, you know. So, what do you got now? You got a... Oh, an ESV. Oh, yeah, isn't that cool looking? Is that one of... Sorry, I want to know. Is that one of those duotone things, or what is that on the back there? What is that? It's kind of cool.
It's not genuine leather.
Yeah, I just want to feel this. Sorry, interrupt the commercial time.
Ooh! I like the soft stuff better than the genuine.
Yeah, but you hear my wife? Bible lust. That's what's happening right now. Oh, it doesn't say. Isn't this cool? Oh, okay. I get it. Your husband says knock it off. Oh, no. See, I have the holy... Okay. So, you may have the nice cover, but I got all these ridiculous notes. You know when you... Okay, so. They took down the body of Jesus, wound it in linen cloths or strips with the spices as the manner of Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and the garden, a new sepulcher, which never man had been laid. There laid they Jesus, therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day, the sepulcher was at hand. Now, let me do something for you real quick, because I talked to you about the nature of this burial practice and the winding around of the strips and the gummy resin and all that kind of a thing. All right, and it gets hard. On the one hand, you know, this is a desert. Okay, so it's arid. They put him in this tomb, and they shut the situation down. We'll talk about that in just a minute. After, in chapter 20 here of John, after Mary comes and makes it to the disciples and starts telling them about this, she gets Peter and John to come along. They're running back. She's clearly trailing way in the back. John's at the head of the pack, and Peter's somewhere in the middle. They reach the tomb. Verse 5 of John chapter 20, and he, Peter, stooping down, looking in, saw the linen clothes lying, yet went he not in. Then cometh Simon Peter, following him, went into the sepulchre, and seeth the linen strips, okay, lie. Now watch. And the napkin, that would have been a turban, because they would wrap the head last. So it'd almost be like something you could take off and put on. The napkin that was about his head was lying with the linen strips,
but wrapped together or twirled, the Greek says, twirled together in a place by itself. Then went in also that other disciple, John, which came first to the sepulcher. He saw and believed. What did he see that kick-started some pretty serious faith here? Well, see it at the bottom of verse 6 where it says, and seeth the linen strips lie. That's the Greek word chemai. Chemai. The mood here of chemai is a participle. So it's not lie. It's really not even lying, but the ing is our English participle, yes? But chemai means to stand. Chemai. In its participle form, standing. So it says he looks into the sepulcher and sees the linen strips standing. Now, not strips standing, you know, all by themselves kind of a thing. What it's telling you is that when Jesus was raised, this will freak Sam Frost right out. There, I just said that. She's going to put that online today. This will make its rounds like it always does. When God raised Jesus from the dead, he essentially evaporated, if you will. I'm going to get jumped on for that word, too. He just left the wrappings, which, like all of us have seen, you know, a cocoon or a chrysalis, you know, when the worm does its thing and then does the butterfly routine, and what's left behind? There's just this chrysalis, and you can kind of crush it, because all of us guys have taken those and crushed it, right? You know? You can look inside, look down through the inside. That's what Jesus was, or what John and Peter were seeing. That's what it means when it says that John looked in, seeing the linen strip standing and the headpiece that was twirled laying by itself. In other words, here's my personal analogy of the situation. You got this cocoon there because the resin, you know, on the strips had hardened, right? And it's a stable thing. I'm not saying it's real hard, but it would have been somewhat, you know, stable. And it's just there. And there's no body inside. There's no... I can't believe... See, here's another... Why, preachers, if you don't know Greek, get out of my face. I don't want to listen to a preacher who can't do this stuff, you know? So what is the deal with that? But in any case, side issue. In any case, this is the benefit for seeing this stuff, for being able to read and work in the Greek text, in particular, Hebrew too. But I mean, there's huge amounts of information in your Greek. So you need to work on this. You need to try to up your skill in regards to stuff like this. Because you read the average translation, it's not going to say that. It doesn't even come out that way in the Amplified. You would think the Amplified would at least bring that out. Okay. But it is in commentaries. They do comment on that. And so they see this right here. Here's what I think. Remember I told you there's this sort of stand, you know, right out of the rock. It's just kind of a table that sticks up right there. And there's that cut-out indentation for a body. I think that what this is saying here is the boys got there, you know, they got the torch or whatever, because nobody's flipping on any lights. They got the torch in there, they're looking, they see the cocoon right there on that raised rock altar, and when it says that the napkin or the headpiece was wrapped, but it was in a place by itself, I think that Jesus leaves that thing. It leaves the cocoon, and the headpiece just sort of falls off, and it's over here by itself. That's just my opinion. I mean, I can't go to town on that. Yeah, Frank?
Well, the headpiece had to be separate so they could tell that the cocoon was a cocoon.
Well, that's true. That's true. That's absolutely true.
The headpiece would have been in place, and they wouldn't know if he was inside it or not.
Yeah, good point. Absolutely. You want my cigar for that? I got some left. I'll bring you one. So it's neat to see this stuff just like it is. So he sees and believes. Oh, my goodness. Now, thank God that nobody got the bright idea of, we should save this here cocoon. Because you know what it'll turn that thing into, you know, and it's all like, that's the end of that. So hopefully it was destroyed or something like that. Because we don't need that type of stuff. We don't need proofs. We don't need physical things or this. We got the Word of God. We got something more important, like Peter said, of greater testimony
than when Peter said, when we had this vision of Jesus being transformed on the mountain, I got a greater word of testimony than that. And then he starts talking about no prophecy of scriptures of any private interpretation. All right, back to Mark. Right at the end of chapter 15, we're about to bust into 16. Here we go. And Mary Magdalene, verse 40, and Mary, the mother of Joseph, beheld where he was laid. And when the Sabbath was passed, Saturday Sabbath, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. Now remember, they're just giving a representative number right here, because we also know from verse 40, we've got Mary, the mother of James, we've got Salome, but then we have a reference to in verse 41 of chapter 15, there were many other women who followed him as well, and we went into Luke to find out that. So it may have just been the three. I think it was at least four, maybe a little bit more. They come to bring the sweet spices that they might come and anoint him, which they couldn't do on Friday. Verse 2, and very early in the morning, Mianton Sabbaton, the first of all the Sabbaths, which we've already been over, we won't cover that ground again, they come unto the sepulchre at the rising of the sun. These poor gals, you know, they just want to minister to the body of Jesus. They're not thinking about this stone, this incredible rock, it's not really a boulder, it's more like a millstone that's just completely shutting this thing. Watch. So they're on their way, verse 3, they said among themselves, who shall roll away the stone from the door of the sepulchre? Now, this stone, it's not like it's huge or anything. It's probably very low. It's probably, probably a few feet wide kind of a thing. Maybe about a foot thick or more than that. And it's a millstone. This is what they use. Now, if you walk up to these sepulchres, and in particular this one near Gordon's Calvary, you got the door right here. Well, the ground sort of slopes up this way. They would make it this way. Build it up, and then they would dig a trench right alongside right there that would head down towards the opening, the door, which is just a cutout, you know, hole. And then they would have a blocking system back here, past the door, just a little past to the right of the door, to stop the stone so it didn't, you know, roll into your neighbor's yard and then you'd get in trouble. All right? And so they have this trench. They would take the stone, and usually there would be a mounded area right behind here where the stone could lean, and then they would turn it. When they were all done, boy, talk about watch your fingers. Turn this thing and just let it go. And they roll it down. And this big, heavy thing, boom, you know, and it just would lock right into place right there. No need for any locks. No need for any alarms. No need for nothing. Nobody's getting into that thing. It's not happening, you see. So who shall roll the stone? These poor gals, you know, they're focused, you know. They're focused on what they want to do. They're loving Jesus, and they're focused, all right? So they get there, of course. They've got this situation, and when they looked, they saw that the stone was rolled away, for it was very great. Well, the Greek reads it was very heavy. Not that it was great and big, but it was very heavy. But now here they show up. This thing is rolled away. Well, you've probably read Matthew's Gospel, the 28th chapter. An angel comes down, right? I love this. An angel comes down, and he's rolling the stone away. But he's rolling it away in front of witnesses. Because remember, the Jewish leadership came to Pilate and said, wait a minute, we remember when that deceiver was alive. He said he was going to raise again in 3 days. Now, set a guard there, right? Set a guard there so that his followers can't perpetuate this, steal the body, and then the error will be worse. And Pilate's just, he's had it with them, and he's just dismissing them. He's saying, you have a watch. Go do what you want. In other words, there was Roman soldiers assigned to the temple that were under the authority of the Sanhedrin. And so that's what he meant by that. They were Roman soldiers over there. So they go to the tomb. These two guys, at least two of them, you know, they think this is a choice, you know, assignment, right? Little do they know what's about to happen. They put the official seal. Now, it's a little questionable to me right now whether this is the Roman seal or the seal of the Sanhedrin. I'm not sure which. I tend to lean towards the Roman seal because the soldiers would have been there to enforce that, you see. And just like at any other time, it's illegal for a Roman soldier to be sleeping on the job. That is a death penalty issue, right? So they're there doing their thing, right? And this angel shows up, scares the holy Wajajis out of these guys. Wajajis. You know what that is, right?
Exactly.
Well, Kerry says that I should write this dictionary. It's Kelly's phrase book or something like that. Scares the woojies right out of these guys, and they like they're frozen. They're so afraid, right? Now I love Matthew's gospel because and watch this humor right here. All right, the angel comes along and it rolls away the stone. I wonder what that looked like. Boo or something like that, right? Flick your little finger or whatever like that. And then I love it. He sits on it. I love the picture. He sits on it. Probably lights up. Maybe not. Anyway, he's sitting on it. And in the meantime, Luke tells us that when the women get in there, and Mary Magdalene is gone now at this point because she sees that the thing is rolled away, she beats feet immediately. This is the correct, and I'll go over some more of this another time, especially when we get into these last 12 verses, because this is one of the first errors that this guy, whoever wrote this, these last 12 verses in Mark 16, this is the error that he makes. But in any case, you know, Mary splits. Mary Mag to go tell the boys. She knows where they are. That something has happened. She hasn't looked inside yet. She does not know, right? She does not know. And the women look inside, and Luke says, there are two young men. They're in shining garments. You know, they're angels. Well, it's the angel from the outside who kicked the boulder open, kicked the thing open and sat on it. And then there was another guy inside. So the guy who kind of got tired of being out there by himself, I don't know, maybe it was rough stone. He jumps down, heads on inside, and now there's two of them in there, and of course the women then meet up with these two angels right there. And that's where we get into some of this that's happening. Verse 5, and entering into the sepulcher, they saw a young man sitting on the right side of where Jesus would have lain, saying, don't be afraid, or dressed in long white garment. They were frightened. Verse 6, he says unto them, don't be afraid. You seek Jesus of Nazareth. Why does he use that term? Why does he say Jesus of Nazareth? Why does he not say, you seek the Messiah? You know, I like the fact Jesus of Nazareth because that zeroes in on his humanity. He who was raised was absolute man, for sure. But at the same time, absolutely divine. And so Jesus of Nazareth, this takes the focus on there has been a bona fide miracle here, prophesied in the Old Testament to take place. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He was killed. There's no swooning going on here. He was crucified. He was put to death. He is risen, because you don't raise somebody who's only partly dead. That would make them partly alive. They're not getting raised. He is risen. Look at his testimony. And he's not here. That validates the angel is testifying, and he's got his other angel buddy there with him. He's got the twofold witnesses taking place, because there's two of them, right? And they're validating and verifying that he's not here. He's risen. Look at the place where they had laid him. Now, look at the place where they had laid him. Look back up at 1547. And Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joseph beheld where he was laid. Make a note of Luke 23:55 right there. Luke 23:55. Watch this. Luke 23:55 says, and the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after and beheld the sepulchre and how, literally, how his body was placed. So much for the argument. See, here's the skinny. If you look back at Mark 16, at the bottom of verse 6, when the angel is saying, he's not here, behold the place where they laid him. This error. There is this, and it's just like this other error I was telling you about. It sticks its head up every so often in church history. You know, the whole swoon theory thing, okay? There's another story out there that basically goes like this. Yeah, okay. You know, they can't disprove Jesus didn't rise from the dead, right? Because men hate this idea, you know? Because if Jesus really rose from the dead, we're dead. I mean, we're all responsible then for whatever. He is God, and whatever God said through him is absolutely right. You know, and we're all going to be held responsible for this, so we got to make sure he hasn't raised from the dead. This is the number one thing that men, unregenerate men, must absolutely disprove, or it puts them on the hook. There's no way around it. So one of the arguments is that, oh, the women, oh, those poor, sobbing, weepy women with their blurry eyes, you know, kind of, they went to the wrong tomb. They went to the wrong one. In fact, one of your Gospels even says that. It says Mark 16:6. The angel says, he's not here. And they go, whoa, he's giving them direction. Jesus, he's not here. And then they've got to, I got a book that says this. You're not going to believe it. It's hard for me to read it with a straight face. And the corners are screwed up because it's done the hurl, you know, on a few, you know, it's hurled years ago. Anyway, he's not here. And then they say, as if the angel then began to point them out the door. It's up the road a piece. You know, it's the other tomb. It's somewhere up there. Behold the place where they laid him. It's up there. He's not here. So behold. Isn't that great? It's great. Ay, 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 ay. No, the text is really clear that they, Luke 23:55, they beheld the sepulcher and how his body was laid. These women locked this stuff in. They didn't get lost. They knew exactly where they were going. Plus, there was at least four of them. Now, one, okay, maybe, get lost, okay. The sun's still coming up. All four of them knew. They knew which one it was. They knew exactly what the inside looked like. They knew how he was laid, right? Then he says to them, but go your way, 16:7 now. Tell his disciples and Peter, he goes before you into Galilee just like he said he would. Well, he said he would meet them in Galilee after his resurrection in Matthew 26:32. Matthew 26:32. It is interesting at the top of verse 7 right here, go your way, tell his disciples and Peter. It's not that Peter wasn't a disciple, but what kind of condition was Peter in at this point? Ooh. Remember last time we saw Peter? Poor Peter. Man, he was just sobbing and crying. He denied the Lord three times. Told the Lord that he wasn't going to do that. And he ends up doing it. Just crushed inside. The angel is delivering a message. Make sure Peter goes. Make sure Peter goes. Because there's a little unfinished business here. The Lord's going to need to heal up Peter. And we see that happen in John 21, don't we? Verse 8. And they went out quickly and fled from the sepulcher. For they trembled and were amazed. Neither said they anything to any man. For they were afraid. These women, I'll show you next time. These women were the ones who were the first to meet Jesus outside the tomb. Mary Magdalene was after that. In the chronology, if you put all the gospel accounts together, that's how the chronology works. But verse 9, which is the first of the spurious verses, says what? Jesus raised first day of, early on the first day of the week, appeared first to who? Whoops. That's the first knock that goes down. But never mind that for right now. Let's finish up.
Resurrection of Christ is the linchpin. People will say, ah, he didn't really die on the cross. He wasn't really raised. Really? Yeah, he was only on the cross for 6 hours. Most of those guys are, yeah, okay. What about the spear shoved up into his side? Blah, 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 blah. Up into his side, pierced the pericardium, went into his heart. That's why John says that he witnessed what he called blood and water coming out. Interesting.
First service people. Interesting how the water came out of the Bethel stone and blood and water. Okay, just thought I'd throw that at you real quick. In any case, he was dead. Dead as dead can be. Well, the disciples, they came and stole him. Well, that's what the Jews, that's a story that the Jews circulated in Matthew 28. They said, the soldiers came back and reported to their masters, the Sanhedrin, what took place. And this angel showed up and they were like frightened to death and they got the heck out of Dodge right there. And they the Sanhedrin guys, let's just dismiss that. You know, they paid him a bunch of money to say, just say we were sleeping. And while we were sleeping, the disciples came and got them. Such a stupid story. But Matthew says, and that's the story that circulates among the Jews today. Oh, yeah, those disciples. Yeah, those soldiers, man, they were sleeping, you know. They got it. Really? Okay, A, of course, it would have been a death sentence for, you know, them to be sleeping on the job, you know, but despite the fact that the members of the Sanhedrin says, if this comes to the ears of the governors, Governor, we'll secure you. In other words, we'll make sure that nothing happens to you. You won't die. But how do you know what happened when you were asleep? How the heck do you know anybody came to get him, let alone naming them as disciples, because you was asleep? How did you know that? Da-da, da-da. But that's men for you, you know? So you've got this taking place. Well, the disciples are... There's the other problem with that whole disciple theory right there. The biggest problem is Jesus raised from the dead. These guys are forever changed. And then you've got the book of Acts happening. Before they were fearful, now they are fearless. And many of them, if not all of them, are laying down their lives willingly. What? Who lays down their lives willingly? For a lie. Not just a lie, folks, for a known lie. They know, or they knew, that they were lying. They just made it up. Well, that doesn't make any sense either. Huh? Well, the Jews stole the body. Book of Acts. That doesn't make any sense either. When the disciples started coming out and preaching what? You killed him, God raised him. How would you shut that up if you stole the body, how would you shut that testimony up? Produce the flipping body. And yet, not a peep, not a word. Would have been so easy for that whole thing to be over with. They could have saved all this pain and problem. Jesus tangibly, absolutely, completely rose again from the dead and appeared. But his body was glorified. Yes, it was the same body, but God changed it. Pretty neat. Well, Father, in regards to all these things, we just give